From the Moan Broadcast Center, it's Film Week. I'm Larry Mantle. Our critics this week review Ad Astra, starring Brad Pitt, Tommy Lee Jones, and Ruth Negga. We'll also hear about Downton Abbey's move from television to the big screen, and the documentary Diego Maradona looks at the Argentinian football legend. It's all coming your way on Film Week, right here on 89.3 KPCC. Welcome to Film Week. I'm Larry Mantle. Wonderful to have you with us. I'm joined by film critics Wade Major of Synagogues.com, Claudia Puig, film critic, as well as president of the Los Angeles Film Critics Association, and Charles Solomon, film critic with Animation Scoop and Animation Magazine. First up this week is Ad Astra, a drama directed by James Gray, who co-wrote the screenplay with Ethan Gross. Brad Pitt stars as an astronaut embarking on a journey across the galaxy in search of his missing father.
What can you tell us about the Lima Project?
First manned expedition to the outer solar system, sir. Some 29 years ago.
And the commander was?
He was my father, sir. The ship disappeared approximately 16 years into the mission. No data was ever recovered. Deep space missions were halted after that.
Roy, we have something that might come as quite a shock to you. We believe your father is still alive near Neptune.
Ad Astra. Wade?
I am admittedly biased. I've known James Gray for nearly 30 years, and I think the world of him as a filmmaker. He was an amazing filmmaker as a student, and he's even better now. I think this is James' best film. James has made some great films, and he has a great love for Stanley Kubrick, which comes out in this film in ways that have not necessarily come out in previous films. Effectively, what he's doing is he is taking Heart of Darkness or Apocalypse Now, whichever variation you want, and he's melding it with the sensibilities in the backdrop of 2001 and fusing some of those themes as well. And that's an extraordinary thing to do. You're taking two of the most gargantuan human odysseys ever committed to film or print and trying to find common ground between them. And he does. And that's what's really extraordinary to me. I loved every second of this film. We're having kind of a lunophilia moment where, you know, on the 50th anniversary of the moon landing, we're back into space and we're looking at landing on the moon again, and where everyone is kind of infatuated with that world again. And it's recreated here in a way that I've never seen before. And I just think every performance here, every nuance, every detail is just pitch perfect for me.
Ad Astra, Claudia.
I did not love every second of this film. I did like some of it. I didn't dislike this film, but I found it more inert than compelling. I thought it had visually some moments of great beauty. And I felt like the father-son story was what interested me more, but it felt too little explored and even occasionally kind of trite. I understand that it was, you know, he was trying to do Heart of Darkness in space. I just felt like it had kind of an episodic structure that didn't quite come together for me. I found the lead performances strong. I mean, of course, Brad Pitt was good in it. It was very, very low key. But the story unspooled so slowly that I actually was bored some of the times. And I felt that the plot points felt a little disjointed and vague. And I felt that everybody who wasn't Brad Pitt in the movie was not given enough of a story. Ruth Negga, Liv Tyler, Donald Sutherland, they kind of just popped in, and there just wasn't enough development of all those other characters. So, you know, and I kept making comparisons to Gravity or Interstellar. I found comparisons there. It just didn't work for me.
All right. Ad Astra, the film starring Brad Pitt and Tommy Lee Jones, James Gray, the director and co-screenwriter with Ethan Gross, rated PG-13 in wide release. Downton Abbey, the period drama that was television series extraordinarily popular, now moves to the big screen. Michael Engler directs. Julian Fellowes, who was the showrunner, the screenwriter here, the film following the wealthy Crawley family as they await a visit from the king and queen to Downton Abbey. Fans of the TV show recognize many of the cast members, including Maggie Smith, Elizabeth McGovern, and Penelope Wilton.
Seems rather a waste of money.
Oh, here we go.
Isn't that what the monarchy's for? To brighten the lives of the nation with stateliness and glamour? To quote Tennyson,
Kind hearts are more than coronets, and simple faith than Norman blood.
Will you have enough cliches to get you through the visit?
If not, I'll come to you.
Downton Abbey, the film. Love that clip. Claudia, what'd you think?
That was a perfect clip to show. I, full disclosure, I'm a big fan of the show. I watched it all and then some, probably over, you know, a couple of times. The writing can be so much fun. And Maggie Smith's little bone mows are everything. And they are in full regalia here. They are just plentiful, more than usual. Yes, it was predictable. You know, the story, they brought in this kind of broad storyline of having the king and queen come to visit and, you know, everybody scurrying around. And but it did create interesting plot points for both the aristocracy and their servants. And it's very satisfying. It's just, it's sort of like, you know, a good cup of tea and some warm slippers. It's, you know, you have Tom.
Well said.
You have Tom Branson, the former Irish firebrand, who gets a new plot line. You have Edith looking more glamorous than morose. You have Maggie Smith, of course, with all those great zingers. Imelda Staunton joins the family as a distant cousin. And then you have all, you know, the usual sort of locking of horns between Penelope Stilton as Isabel and Violet, Granny. And then, you know, if you loved old Carson, he's back. And Mr. Thomas Barrow actually gets a really interesting storyline.
Great storyline.
Wonderful storyline. And then Daisy and Mrs. Patmore get a little bit more than usual. I feel like the Earl of Grantham and Lady Grantham got a little bit less. And the dog got a lot less. There was a new dog that no one really paid any attention to.
The kids are growing up.
Yes,
the grandkids
yes.
are growing up.
Yeah, but it worked for me. I thought it distilled, you know, so many of the ingredients that made the show so beloved.
Charles, what'd you think?
Well, I enjoyed it. I wasn't as big a fan of the series, but I think it has some problems. There are too many subplots, and there are many too many endings. There are about eight of them, and they don't need all of those. There are several lines where you think, okay, that's a good line to end on, and then, oh, we're back for something else. Of course, I bow to no one in adoring Maggie Smith, and when she announces something like, I don't argue, I explain, you know, you get this frisson of delight. A lot of the story is driven by whenever the King of England, as many of the older monarchs did, wherever he goes, he is at home and in residence. So his own servants come and take over. And of course, the Downton servants are furious and not being allowed to serve the king and being turned out of their own places. Lots of fun. What this felt to me a lot like, though, was that this is a transitional piece that they're probably thinking about a new season or seasons, and that certain of the actors want out. And it looks like the focus is switching to the Irish character.
Thomas Branson. Yeah, Branson.
And that they've introduced an interesting new character with Imelda Staunton, who was also wonderful to put up against Maggie Smith because, you know, the two of them can out-act anybody.
It's like a Harry Potter reunion.
And out-arch anybody.
Yeah.
So that's lots of fun, and it's interesting, but I wouldn't be surprised if this follows with something with the focus
shifting.
Maybe another movie.
Yeah, Wade, what'd you think?
I love it, and I'm a fan of the series, too. I've seen every episode probably at least twice, and some of them maybe three times. There's something inherently very smart about Downton Abbey that it doesn't get enough credit for, and this goes to Julian Fellowes, and it's the baby bathwater factor to it, which is that this is a show essentially it's set against a very compelling historical backdrop. That you've had World War I and the flu epidemic, and they even mention Hitler at one point when as a young politician in Germany, and there are all of these things happening in the actual historical backdrop. And that is meant to communicate to us, obviously, the loss of a certain Edwardian moment, a certain part of Edwardian culture that we know would soon fade away. But at the same time, Julian Fellowes is very aware of the fact that we are letting certain things go with it that we shouldn't. We should try to preserve certain things, certain sense of respect and dignity
civility.
And manner and civility, and that there are things in the culture that you should not let fade away, even as that sort of tradition, as those traditions of the aristocracy go away.
This and from the inhabitant of Manor at Wade Abbey.
Yes. And he wants us to consider that. And every second of the show and every second of this movie is pleading with us, yes, you do. There, you should be melancholy that some of this is going away. You should be glad that we're taking a step toward modernity, but don't throw away the things that really, really matter. And it's a wonderful plea, and it gets in our heart. And these characters have found their ways into our heart,
and they find a way of weaving in the modernity too with with Thomas's character.
Very much.
I thought that was a really interesting Thomas Barrow's character, who started out as a villain early on, mm-hmm. and has kind of expanded. We see what he was suffering, being gay, and all of that. And it's I thought his character arc was fascinating.
Now that he's butler and he's more assertive, and there's that wonderful moment where Lord Grantham is impressed by him, that he talks back, and you just think, and it Julian Fellowes knows these characters as if they were members of his own family, and he writes them so beautifully, and he doesn't try to overreach. He's not trying to make this the summation, the big capper of the Downton saga. He says, no, these are basically two more episodes. We had some more money to spend, so we upped the ante and we upped the production value. But I'm gonna keep this story going as long as I can, and we may get another movie or two or three. Who knows?
All right. Downton Abbey, the film, directed by Michael Engler, Julian Fellowes, who created the television series and was the showrunner of the series, the screenwriter here. It's rated PG in wide release. The documentary Diego Maradona tells the story of the great Argentinian player who had a remarkable life as well. Over 500 hours of never-before-seen footage of Diego Maradona are included both on and off the field. Wade, what'd you think of the doc?
I thought it was extraordinary. I am a longtime fan of Asif Kapadia. I've interviewed him a few times, all the way back to 2001 with his debut film, The Warrior, which was a UK submission in the foreign language category and got caught in the Miramax library, the Miramax closet at that time. And he fought his way out of that career setback as a great documentarian. Senna being the crowning achievement of his career.
The
Amy Winehouse doc, amazing,
yeah.
Amy. I think this is very much in the same vein as those. It's hard for me to say if this is better. It might be. I'm a little bit biased because here's one of my favorite filmmakers in the world making a documentary about a character I absolutely loathe. I am a huge soccer fan, and I rooted against Maradona every second of the late 80s and early 90s. I found myself remarkably compelled by this story. It doesn't make him any less of a villain or any more of a hero than he already is to everyone else, but it does try to get inside that villain-hero dichotomy that made Maradona such a mercurial figure for so long. And you learn a great deal about him, and the archival footage is stunning. I don't know where they came up with some of it. It must have been a needle in a haystack effort to come up with some of this material. But what an amazing tapestry. And it's and the craft of it is quite beautiful. It's entirely done. All the interviews are done in voiceover. You don't see the interview subjects. They simply narrate this footage, which is, compiled in what must have been an editorial undertaking of epic proportions. Quite an impressive film.
What do you think, Claudia?
I was also very impressed by it. And I'm also a huge fan of Asif Kapadia. But we approach it from very different angles because I am not a football/soccer fan. I'd never heard of Diego Maradona. I've only heard of Pelé and David Beckham. So
yeah.
I'm so not a soccer person. So he was a name that meant nothing to me. So I didn't go into it with any kind of hate or rancor. I just was like, okay, let's see who this guy is. And the thing about Asif Kapadia, I think, is he can make anyone interesting. He can make someone who is – he just has a way. He's such a great filmmaker, and he is so – he's so fascinated by the idea of a rise and fall and how much early fame, whether it was Senna, whether it was Amy Winehouse, whether it's him. And this is almost like the third part of a trilogy of exploring, what can happen to you with early fame and the tragedies that can befall you.
They're like Greek tragedies.
They are like Greek tragedies. Yeah. And if you read about it somewhere, it's almost like he's a novelistic figure. And I felt a lot of compassion for him. I felt really badly for him because he was this guy from extreme poverty in Buenos Aires. And then he is, picked up and plucked into this, and he's deified. I mean, they literally deified. They have, they put his picture up and, in the churches of Naples, and he's made into this saint. And then he is brought down, and they call him Lucifer and Satan. So, I mean, it's talk about a rise and fall. It's just such a dramatic rise and fall. And it's such a great match of filmmaker and subject, I think. He has a way of looking at early success and its tragic consequences that I think is just so probing. And he doesn't, you know, do the kind of narration. He just lets the story tell itself with all his amazing footage.
I will say my one reservation is they give the 1990 World Cup rematch between Germany and Argentina, where Germany beat Argentina and denied him back-to-back World Cup wins, which only Pelé has ever done before. That was given very short shrift. I wish they had spent more time to just satisfy my sense of vengeance from 1990.
Just for you.
Just for me.
The documentary is titled The Name of Its Subject, Diego Maradona. Asif Kapadia is the director of the documentary. You can see it at Lemley's Glendale Theater. It also, beginning in October, will be shown on HBO and streaming on HBO Now. The film is unrated. We have much more to come on Film Week. Reviews of Rambo Last Blood. Yes, Sylvester Stallone is back as that character. And the documentary Moonlight Sonata. Film Week on KPCC. Great to have you with us on Film Week. I'm Larry Mantle with critics Charles Solomon, Claudia Puig, and Wade Major. Next up, Rambo Last Blood. Sylvester Stallone is back in that role of Rambo. Adrian Grunberg is the director, and Matthew Cerulnik is the screenwriter along with Sylvester Stallone. Claudia?
Was I am actually glad I saw it, so that I can warn people away from seeing it. And I would actually urge people, particularly Latinos who are a major segment of the movie going public, to boycott it, because it is so racist. In addition to being offensive in its sadism, the director Adrian Grunberg made a film called Get the Gringo. This one could be called Get the Mexican. Half the movie takes place in Mexico, and Mexicans are largely portrayed, with the exception of one, and we're talking many, many others, portrayed as vicious, uber-violent, foul-mouthed, and the darker skin they are, the more evil they are. The only positive thing I can say about it is that it's a blessed 89 minutes. So there's that. But there's no reason for this movie to exist. It's gory, it's grotesque, it's vicious, it's, as mentioned, it's offensive. It's so not the movie we need in these times of racial hatred and excessive gun violence. And I realize that he's a cartoonish character, but the storyline is that he has this kind of daughter figure. She's not a daughter, but a family he's sort of taken in, and they're Mexican-American, and she goes down to find her father in Mexico. They never say what town or anything. And she gets kidnapped, essentially, for sort of sex trafficked. And the very real problem of human trafficking is both glossed over and exploited in the way that they do this. And it's just used as kind of a convenient plot point for him to mete out all his torturous, vengeant acts. And his barbarism really knows no bounds here. He is, you know, his torture includes decapitating, pulling bones and organs out of people's bodies, impaling people. You know, you think of some obscure, it's sort of like, what was that movie that was The Many Ways to Die? Well, there's been a few of those, but it's like Saw. I mean, it has that kind of, it's actually stomach churning, and it's jingoistic, and it's really badly written. He co-wrote it. He should really stick to Rocky. There's a line where he says, I know how black a man's heart is, and, you know, I'm just trying to keep a lid on it every day, and you only wish that he had kept a lid on it.
Rambo Last Blood in wide release. It's rated R. The documentary Moonlight Sonata, Deafness in Three Movements, is directed by Irene Taylor Brodsky. Claudia?
I love this documentary. It's interesting because we're looking at, I think, three different documentaries this week, and each one of them has a very different style. When you look at Asif Kapadia's style, you know, it's compiling mass amounts of archival footage and letting that tell the story and excavating all those. In this film, Irene Taylor Brodsky does a kind of a cinema verite, but also home movie style of film, in which she uses her son and her parents as the subjects to explore deafness, and not as a, you know, tragedy that befalls you, but as sort of perhaps it's something to retreat into. Perhaps people who have the option of actually tuning out the world and going into a quiet place have an advantage. And she connects her son, who is going deaf and has a cochlear implant, with her parents, who were born deaf or were deaf ever since she knew them, since she came into the world. And they also have cochlear implants, but at times they just turn them off because they, you know, are soothed by the quiet. And I just felt this was really beautifully done. It asked fascinating questions about the world around us, and I loved the viewpoints, and I liked how it interwove Beethoven, who her son has a great love for. He loves the Peace Moonlight Sonata. He wants to play it in a recital, and he's a normal kind of kid, so he's an interesting subject. He's not a prodigy or
about
a genius.
How old's the kid?
11.
Okay.
And he's a typical kid in that sometimes he's kind of lazy and doesn't want to practice, and other times he, talks back and gets emotional. But he also has this beautiful bond with her father, with his grandfather. And it's really wonderful to see that and to see it from so up close and intimate a view that she takes. I found it a really interesting documentary.
We're talking about Moonlight Sonata, deafness in three movements. Wade?
Everything Claudia said and more. It is deeply moving. And because it is so personal, it makes its points, I think, with greater moral authority than if the filmmaker were someone simply approaching this subject from the outside. Very personal to me. My mother would have been deaf if not for the Stapes surgery. She was one of the first to get those back in the 1950s. And
grandmother too.
Yeah, I mean that was before cochlear. There was that, and that was, and it did very much the same thing at the same time. And then it migrates to treating the issue of dementia, which is kind of a surprising turn in the film. And I'm not giving anything necessarily away, but, I've done two tours as a dementia caregiver as well. And those two subjects together kind of represent an enormous challenge for an increasing number of people in society. And that's why I was grateful for it. Every year, the number of people who are dealing with dementia and hearing loss, whether it's straight up deafness or just, the aging process and the toll that it takes on hearing, we're getting millions and millions more. And the generation that is having to deal with that is getting older and older themselves. And to have someone so close to both of those things here share her experience is edifying, and it is strengthening. And I think it's a vital film and really important, and it arrives at a great moment in time.
Charles, what do you think of Moonlight Sonata?
I wasn't edified, and I wasn't strengthened, because I think this film is lacking terribly in structure and focus. It begins with a very interesting idea that because the boy gets his cochlear implants when he's quite young, he has a different relationship to sound and to what it means and to how to interpret it than the filmmaker's parents do, who only got them very late in life and grew up in an absence of sound and really have trouble perceiving it and what it means. The problem of grandpa developing dementia is a completely different subject. It's not linked to deafness. It should have been another film, and I think this degenerates into sitting through her home movies.
I don't see how you could have made another film, because that was what was happening.
But it's irrelevant to the subject of deafness.
But it's not irrelevant to a family. And I think if you're going to turn the camera on your family.
If this is about her family, what about the other two little boys and her husband who get cut out except to make some noise in the background?
All right, the film Moonlight Sonata, Deafness in Three Movements, Irene Taylor-Brodsky, the director. It's unrated. It's at Lemley's Royal Theater in West L.A. Also out this week, the documentary Where's My Roy Cohn, directed by Matt Tiernauer. This about the controversial attorney best known for being Senator Joseph McCarthy's chief counsel during the McCarthy hearings of 1954.
Roy Cohn began this whole new mode of what you see today of get off the issue, attack law enforcement, attack the government, attack the press, create phony issues so that you can totally change the debate.
Here's a little McCarthyism going on right now.
He shouldn't disclaim, total inability to cope with any of these current topics. He does it with great precision.
This is known as filler. You throw your mud and then the filler goes on until they've forgotten what the point was.
Where's My Roy Cohn? The documentary, Matt Tiernauer is the director. Claudia?
I thought this was a fascinating documentary. The format of this documentary is a much more straightforward with talking heads.
Still a rise and fall, though.
It is a rise and fall. Yeah. Well, yes, that's true. And Roy Cohn, of course, is an inherently fascinating subject for a documentary. I don't think it's necessarily a definitive film about him, because sometimes it feels like there's a checklist of his kind of greatest hits or worst hits in his case. I found it more intriguing as a character study of the American zeitgeist and kind of, that Roy Cohn was the common thread going back to the 50s, going back to Senator Joe McCarthy and going up to Donald Trump. And he was his – Trump was his protege. And that was, to me, one of the most interesting parts. And that certainly was focused on by Matt Tiernauer, who did Studio 54 last year and has done Citizen Jane, has done some good documentaries. I enjoyed it completely. I mean, we – I would love to count how many times I heard the words manipulative, Machiavellian, you know, power mad, all those things. But he was all those things. And then one of his cousins says he was an evil produced by certain currents in the American culture. And people, you know, I loved that. I think the most interesting observations came from people who were closest to him, which makes perfect sense.
His
former lover, his cousins, his colleagues, Roger Stone. That was interesting. And it's, you know, the connection to Trump I thought was fascinating because he taught him certain things like, you know, never admit to anything, lie if you have to. There were actual, you know, little homilies that he seemed to have given him to, you know, turn things around, make something about something else if you're being focused on, because he represented him and Fred Trump back in
over their real estate.
Civil rights issue. And I like that they looked back and, you know, they said he loved pulling the levers of power and he got a taste for it early in life. At 15 years old, he made his first bribe. He got a teacher out of traffic school when he was in high school. I mean, he was making wheeling and dealing from the minute he came
born
out of the womb. Yeah.
Where's my Roy Cohn, Wade?
It's a terrific doc. I think I like Citizen Jane of all of Matt Tiernauer's films. I like Citizen Jane the most. It is the most cohesive and self-contained story. I think that's a wonderful doc. But, you know, and Claudia said, is it definitive? I don't know that you can be definitive of Roy Cohn. You're talking about one of the most complex and conflicted and mythic. Talk about Greek tragedy.
Yes.
There's so much going
he's
on here.
He's a contradiction unto himself.
There's
I was
so
wondering
much
if you could even make a documentary about it.
Yeah. There's so much to unpack. Things that I didn't know, you know, the arranged marriage of his parents. So much about his what does it mean for him to be Jewish? What does it mean for him as a gay man who refused to admit that he was gay, even as he's dying
kind of
from
a self-hating Jew and a self-hating gay
exactly.
man.
Exactly.
Yeah. I was astonished to learn from Claudia he had a lover.
Oh, well.
Well, I think the one that was interviewed, yeah. And he had a type. It was very much a kind of a waspish Germanic
Nordic type.
Nordic, yeah.
And you know, the fact that there he is clearly dying from AIDS and still refusing, just in the face of all evidence and knowledge to the contrary, will not allow that to be a reality that's associated with him. There's a lot to unpack psychologically. I don't think the film unpacks all of it, but it doesn't need to. It gets us interested enough. It piques our curiosity. It restores him into the middle of a cultural conversation at a time when I think we need to talk about him. The two things that I think are an unfortunate drawback, one, are the two people that they needed to interview to create a more complete portrait, which is Donald Trump and Barbara Walters. Neither of them are here.
I didn't know about the Barbara Walters connection.
Oh, I did. I remember that very well.
I have a whole new view of her now.
Well,
that's not good.
and so sort of without them, I Trump doesn't really show up until the last third of the film. I think they maybe try to connect Roy Cohn too much to explain Donald Trump, because Trump was already Trump when he met Cohn. It was on more a meeting of the minds.
But he sort of sought advice from him, and then Cohn said to him, go on the defensive and attack the government, attack the press,
but Trump
create
was already,
phony issues.
He was already doing that at that time anyway.
But he sort of
He may have reinforced it. Yeah.
The film Where's My Roy Cohn at the ArcLight Hollywood, the Landmark in West L.A. It's rated PG-13. The Swedish comedic drama Britt Marie Was Here is directed by Tuva Nadvatny, she's one of the screenwriters as well. Wade?
Love this film. Stars Pernilla August, who's married to Billy August and who starred in Billy August, The Best Intentions, which won the Cannes Film Festival 25 years ago. And she is wonderful. This is two genres in one. It's the old age looking to restart your life genre and the underdog sports genre. She's an older woman whose marriage falls apart, and she winds up getting a job coaching a youth's soccer team of primarily immigrant and poor kids. And she has no experience in soccer, knows nothing about it.
It's the second soccer movie of the week.
It is. And it's formula, but it's charming.
Yes, it's charming. It's pleasant. It's light. She's great. I thought she had a very restrained lead performance. She was very genial. And it avoids being maudlin or sugary sweet. So it worked.
Sounds like kind of film might have some, for a foreign language film, commercial potential.
I can totally see it being remade in the English language and maybe Imelda Staunton starring in it, or Jerry Jones if it was American.
Yeah, it sounds like there's a lot of appeal in the concept.
Oh, yes.
Britt Marie was here, a Swedish film. You can see it at a number of the Lemley theaters here in Southern California. It's unrated. Coming up, we have many more films to talk about with our critics. It's Film Week on 89.3 KPCC. Wonderful to have you with us on Film Week. I'm Larry Mantle. A lot of movies out this week. We're taking you through them one by one. I'm joined by critics Charles Solomon, Wade Major, and Claudia Puig. Next up is the Japanese animated sci-fi film Promare. It's directed by Hiroyuki Imaishi. Charles, what'd you think of this?
This is great fun and the film for anime fans this weekend. Imaishi created Gurren Lagann, a very popular series. And what I love about this movie is after complaining here and in print about how much the same American animated films have started to look, that everything is so detailed and you see every hair and every stitch in the sweater. This feels closer to Yellow Submarine. The palette is day-glow. It just explodes onto the screen in this kind of spin wheel of action and activity and fights and battles. It's set in a kind of dystopic future where one section of humanity became burnished, people who could manipulate fire. They were defeated in a series of battles. Now they're rising again under a charismatic new leader. And this puts them in opposition to Gelo Thamos, the great fireman hero figure, who's very much like one of the Gurren Lagann characters. He charges in. You know, a guy's got to do what a guy's got to do. He's silly. He's funny. He's over the top. And again, after these hyper-realistic characters, to see a film that just revels in being drawn, even more, I think, than Spider-Verse did, it's just fun and refreshing and very different. And if you're at all interested in anime or in just how far you can push design and color, this is the film for you.
Is this for you one of the top animated films of the year?
I like its originality and excitement. It's not the greatest storytelling in the world or dealing with any maybe serious issues, but it's a lot of fun.
Promare is the film. It's rated PG-13 in select theaters. Augie, a sci-fi drama, stars Richard Kind and Kristen Harper. Matt Cain is the director and co-screenwriter with Mark Underhill. Wade?
This is quite a smart little independent film. This is kind of a low-budget independent version of Her, the Oscar-winning Spike Jonze film of some years ago. Richard Kind is a guy who's just basically been laid off. He's redundant now at his job, and what's he going to do with the rest of his life at a very moment when his wife's career is taking off? He feels disconnected. He feels useless. And one of the parting gifts that they give him at his job are these virtual reality glasses. That's the sci-fi part of this, where when you put them on, you see a companion, a virtual companion, and in this case, a beautiful young woman who understands him and she knows him. And it's all kind of coming out of his own mind. And she winds up becoming basically someone he has an affair with, a virtual affair. She disconnects him from his family and from the real world. And he loses himself in this fake relationship. And the film is very smart about how it approaches this. It's not a sensational thing. It doesn't overplay the sexual aspect of it. And Richard Kind is such a good character actor. You know, he goes back so far. It's great to see him get a role where he gets to be the lead and not the comic relief. And it's sad and it's touching and it's provocative and it's quite a good little film.
And a directorial debut for Matt Cain.
Yep.
Augie, the film, it's unrated. It's at Lemley's Monica Film Center, Santa Monica. Also can be seen on video on demand. The Wedding Year, comedy starring Sarah Hyland and Tyler James Williams. Robert Luketic is the director and Donald Diego wrote the screenplay. Claudia.
This is a pretty slight romantic comedy. It feels like something you would see on TV. It feels like some of the lesser Netflix romantic comedies that have been out. It's fine. It's a way to spend a couple hours. I wouldn't, you know, rush out to see it. But Robert Luketic, or Luketic, I'm not sure how to pronounce his name, directed Legally Blonde. So, you know, he certainly knows how to do romantic comedy. The stars, Sarah Hyland and Tyler James Williams, are very likable, and they have a certain amount of chemistry. She was one of the key characters on Modern Family, one of the young girls. He was in Everybody Hates Chris. So these are, you know, definitely actors from popular TV series. And it's about two people who are on the lists of they're at that age where everybody's getting married. And so they're on the list. They're constantly being asked to go to weddings, and then they fall for each other and decide to get married. And it's all the things that happen to sort of get in the way of that. So it's, you know, it's it feels like we may have seen this before, but they do have a nice chemistry, and they're an interracial couple. And that's never particularly brought up. But they're not, they don't make a whole lot out of that, which is a nice thing. So there's some forced moments, but in general, it, you know, there are moments when it's, there's some humor to it too. So it's a middling romantic comedy, I would say.
The Wedding Year, the romantic comedy, and Robert Luketic, the director, did direct Legally Blonde, Ugly Truth, and 21. Donald Diego wrote the screenplay. It's rated R in select theaters. The thriller American Dreamer stars Jim Gaffigan, Robbie Jones. It's directed by Derek Bort, who co-wrote the screenplay with Daniel Fort. Wade, what'd you think of American Dreamer?
Yet another offspring from Taxi Driver. We get these every so often, and they're all kind of doing the same thing. And very often they star comics who are trying to cut their chops as dramatic actors. Jim Gaffigan is really, really good here. He's an unstable guy whose marriage is disintegrated, and she has a restraining order against him, and he can't see his child. And he's basically driving an Uber. And winds up driving around a drug dealer and gets some ideas based on being a little bit too acquainted with this drug dealer as to how he can turn his life around. Well, naturally, all his ideas of turning his life around are wrong, and they just create one catastrophe after another, and everything winds up, as in Taxi Driver, going very, very dark. It's not necessarily surprising. It's not always logical. It takes some turns that feel very, very contrived. But you're watching this basically to watch Gaffigan work and do something that we've never seen him do before. And in that regard, it's very rewarding.
Claudia, what do you think of American Dreamer?
In that regard, I think he's playing against type, and he shows that he's a good dramatic actor. Yeah. He also looks a lot like Philip Seymour Hoffman in Before the Devil Knows You're Dead.
Oh, he does.
Doesn't
yeah.
he?
Yes, he
Which
does.
Which is a fantastic movie. I would recommend people go back and see Before the Devil Knows You're Dead, and maybe not this one. but, you know, some of the problems I had with the plot, I think he does a pretty good job, but the choice that they make of how he is going to get money from this drug dealer, and the drug dealer is pretty stereotypically
played. There's some pretty big jumps of logic.
And it's pretty disturbing in terms of child imperilment and all that. So I have some mixed feelings about this, but I do think it definitely shows his dramatic acting chops.
American Dreamer, starring Jim Gaffigan, Derek Bort, the director and co-screenwriter. Film is rated R. It's at Lemley's Monica Film Center, Santa Monica. Primal is a TV series, but is getting a theatrical release for this action animated film. It's created by Genndy Tartakovsky. Charles, what do you think of Primal?
Well, I'm a huge admirer of Genndy Tartakovsky, who brought us Dexter's Laboratory and Samurai Jack, and have whined on this show in the past about he deserves something better than the Hotel Transylvania movies and propping up Adam Sandler. And this is Genndy going back to being Genndy. I didn't love it as much as I do Samurai Jack, but it's told entirely in mime with sound effects. The graphics are striking and original and minimal. Gorgeous backgrounds. It's not terribly scientific, because you have a caveman who's lost his family, and a small theropod carnivorous dinosaur who's lost his, and they sort of bond and struggle for existence in this very violent world. This is not a cartoon for kids at all, but Genndy is such a skillful director and just makes the material interesting, communicates even with minimal animation through body language and expression. And it's just fun to see him doing something on his own that he does so well. So I really enjoyed it.
Now, is this episodic at all because it's television?
Yeah, it's basically, I assume, the first four episodes of a series. I certainly hope there are more. I really like three of them. One I wasn't quite so high on. But I hope this is something that's continuing because, again, we need this kind of original voice and vision.
Do we know if he has an outlet yet on TV?
Yes, it's going to be, I believe, on Cartoon Network.
All right. This chance to see it on the big screen at the Downtown Independent, downtown Los Angeles, week-long run initiating on Saturday. Primal TV series, but to be shown theatrically at Downtown Independent, is rated TVMA for mature audiences. Coming up, we'll hear what Claudia thinks of the thriller Imprisoned. She also saw Villains. Boy, she's getting all these tough films. That's why you roll brass knuckles into the studio. We'll continue with Film Week in 1 minute.
There's been a lot of heat about climate change.
AOC's climate change con.
After Sandy, you don't find a lot of climate change deniers in New York City.
So with hundreds of journalists and researchers around the world, we're shedding light on the topic with a week of special reports. The facts about what's happening, why it's happening, and what can be done.
One little thing you can do on your little piece of land is to create some habitat.
Covering climate now, all this week on 89.3 KPCC.
Wonderful to have you with us on Film Week. I'm Larry Mantle. Our critics this week, Wade Major, Claudia Puig, Charles Solomon. And Claudia, continuing with her theme of all these rough films, next up has the thriller Imprisoned, starring Juan Pablo Rava. It's written and directed by Paul Kampf. Claudia?
Maybe I need a romantic comedy.
Yeah, right.
Well, you know, this was well-meaning in its condemnation of capital punishment, but it's pretty dully executed. It has a great cast, and I wish it had been better. And ultimately, they dedicated to the indomitable spirit of the Puerto Rican people, which I thought was wonderful. Intrinsically, this is kind of an interesting story, but it ends up being flat and kind of – it's both flat and overheated. It alternates between both of those, which is neither of them are good. And it's kind of generic, and it's being sort of a prison thriller. There's some very good performances. It's got a great cast, including Edward James Olmos, Isai Morales, Lawrence Fishburne. Lawrence Fishburne speaks damn good Spanish. I was very impressed
by that.
That's
interesting.
A whole lot better than Sylvester Stallone, I will say.
Is the whole film in Spanish or mixed?
Yes, mixed. It's largely in Spanish. And it's this, prison melodrama, and he's framed for – the main guy is originally – he was responsible for, I don't want to give too much away, for the death of Lawrence Fishburne's loved ones. And so he ends up framing him for another crime, and then he ends up being on death row, essentially. And by the way, Puerto Rico hasn't had capital punishment since 1929. It was abolished.
Is the prison in Puerto Rico or the States?
The prison is in Puerto Rico.
It's in Puerto Rico.
Yeah,
okay.
And it looks very much like an Alcatraz. It's on this sort of very dramatic coastline, and the last time they had a hanging was in 1927. This was not taking place then. But it has some fairly heavy-handed symbolism, and then sort of the emotional parts feel a little bit overwrought. But so I feel like it was more of a admirable effort than it was, ultimately a good thriller, unfortunately.
Imprisoned is the film. Paul Kampf, the writer-director. It's rated R at Lemley's Music Hall in Beverly Hills. Claudia also saw Villains, a comedic horror movie written and directed by Dan Burke and Robert Olson.
This is a fairly funny black comedy. It's kind of a love story, and a twisted, very twisted love story. And it's fairly entertaining and offbeat. It involves a kidnapping, a very twisted suburban couple, played by Kyra Sedgwick and Jeffrey Donovan. And it's this black comedy, and the scenario is kind of a surprise. You have these two young couple who are very, in love, and they are also criminals, but their crime is more like, holding up a convenience store. And then they, through a series of events, they end up in this house where they're trying to kind of figure out their next step because they've run out of gas. And things, the tables are turned on them, and it becomes a much more kind of threatening situation for them. And Bill Skarsgård plays one of the felons, and Micah Monroe, who's really quite good. It's a fun movie. I mean, it's nicely assembled. There's a great production design. The house looks like something out of sort of the Brady Bunch, or maybe even earlier, kind of the 60s. And the people sort of seem cryogenically frozen from the 50s and 60s, the couple. So it's fun. It's, you know, nothing great, but it's fairly a little bit unusual in sort of how it's twisting up the crime thriller genre.
Villains is in select theaters. It's rated R. Also, it's the 25th anniversary of The Shawshank Redemption. Tim Robbins and Morgan Freeman star in the film. Frank Darabont, the writer-director of the series, before he'd go on to do The Walking Dead on TV. Wade, take us back to what you particularly like about Shawshank.
I love The Shawshank Redemption. It came at a particularly I had just begun as a film critic at the time, so you're prepared to go in with daggers out every time you see a movie, and I couldn't find anything wrong with this film. It just washed over me in a really beautiful way, partly because I think it was based on a novella. Stephen King's books have always made for difficult translation to film because they are dense and they're thick and they're huge, like It, you know, had two movies and it still doesn't encompass it all. This was a novella based on a Tolstoy story, and everything was there. And so Darabont had a lot to work with and time and space to let it breathe and let the characters become who they were. And I think it, speaking of capital punishment, it certainly has a lot to say about a lot of things, including the justice system, friendship, morality, ethics, and it does it all beautifully.
Your thoughts?
I agree completely with what you said. I remember just being really mesmerized by the performances of Tim Robbins and Morgan Freeman. That was what, and Morgan Freeman particularly, I remember just that is what stayed with me over the years.
Am I confusing this with something else, or is this where they play the aria from The Marriage of Figaro suddenly into the prison?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's the only thing I remember.
And that, you'll have to see it again.
94 was a long time ago.
That's the Countess and Susanna plotting to undo the Count's evil, lecherous schemes. I don't understand what it was doing there.
The Shawshank Redemption is getting select theater screenings on Sunday, Tuesday, and Wednesday. You can check your local listings. It's rated R. Also, the documentary getting a re-release, Say Amen, Somebody, about the gospel music artists here in America circa 1982, a 4K restoration. Wade?
Beautiful documentary made when they didn't have video or all the tools we have today. This was on film. They had to make this doc. It's a beautiful documentary. It speaks to exactly how integral gospel music has been in American culture, and especially for the American music industry, how many great artists we owe the gospel background too, and it's just the performances are wonderful. It's
maybe it's worth pairing with Amazing Grace.
Oh, for
I was
sure.
Just thinking that.
Yeah,
that was such a good film.
Say Amen, Somebody, which did quite well on the art house scene in 1982, is getting single day screenings at a number of the Lemley theaters. Again, check Lemley's website or your local listings. The documentary is rated G. Also, wanted to mention that Refugee, a short dramatic film that Wade, you were executive producer of, is getting a screening at
yes,
the Lemley Royal.
And my wife was one of the producers, and written and directed by Brant Anderson, who was a producer on Everest and Lone Survivor. And this is his writing and directing debut, a story of this is our week, Oscar qualifying week. It's playing 4 p.m. From the 20th through the 26th at the Lemley Royal. Story of a Syrian doctor who, with her daughter, is forced to become a refugee and flee their country. We worked hard on this, and we're very proud of it.
All right,
it'd be
congratulations!
So cool to have an Oscar
on
winner
that.
On film week. How good would that be?
He wouldn't come back to us.
Yes, he'd be too big for us.
I used to do that show. Brant Anderson, the writer director of Refugee, the short film. Also want to remind you that our next Film Week screening is of the terrific sci-fi film Blade Runner from Ridley Scott. We're going to show the final cut. That's the one that Ridley Scott actually oversaw. We'll show it on the big screen theater at Ace Hotel Saturday night, November 2nd at 7 p.m. We have a great post-film conversation talking about the movie afterwards. And you probably don't remember, but Blade Runner was set in 2019 Los Angeles. So as we get set to say goodbye to 2019, We're going to do it with a film showing dystopia of Los Angeles in this very year. Things, of course, very different, but nonetheless, great chance for us to enjoy a classic film. The series devoted to movies that are set in Los Angeles. You can get your tickets at kpcc.org/in-person. From all of us at Film Week, have a wonderful weekend.